it's a real honor to be here, particularly on this occasion, and with such a fantastic group of speakers and people who have been leading the campaign against the IMF and the World Bank, and also in the case of Dennis Brutus, the struggle against apartheid. And I want to start tonight by continuing on that theme to discuss some of the connections, how the struggle against the bank, the struggle against the IMF, the broader fight against capitalist globalization, neoliberalism in its current stage, is linked to the struggle against the occupation of Iraq, how we have to understand these two issues as being integrally related. Because to come back to a term that Soren used, if we're going to look at U.S. imperialism today, and I do think that that's the right term to use, we have to understand that U.S. imperialism has always had two primary components, an economic component, which seeks to open up markets, to have access to natural resources, to gain access to labor markets, to impose terms of trade and exchange on other countries, particularly, of course, weaker countries, and a military component, which has always gone hand in hand with that economic drive. A military component, which is about creating an overall framework of order which serves those economic interests, which allows those markets to be accessed, and which will intervene to topple governments that are unfriendly or crush social and popular movements that oppose that economic domination and exploitation. So the two go hand in hand and have to be understood. So we can't talk about the birth 60 years ago in July 1944 of the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, named after the town in New Hampshire where the powers that created the IMF and World Bank gathered, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. You can't talk about those institutions without understanding the historical moment, which is the United States' position at the end of World War II as a result of its military victory and the role that it played militarily and politically in that war. If you go back to that particular moment in history, the 1940s, there's a very important document that was written by a guy named George Kennan, who is the State Department Policy Planning Staff Director. And it laid out, I think, these connections very clearly. He said about the U.S. position at the end of World War II, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security." So the idea is to establish a pattern of relationships, as Kennan calls it. And this pattern of relationships, whether it was Democrats in office or the Republicans in office, meant cultivating allies, brutal allies, like the Shah of Iran, the corrupt ruling families in Saudi Arabia, or the Emirates, Saddam Hussein, when he was a loyal ally of the United States. It meant developing those relationships, of course, also developing the relationship with Israel as a Sparta, as a client state in the region, to check Arab nationalism and popular movements. But it also meant intervening to topple efforts to nationalize, to collectivize resources like oil. So, for example, the United States intervened in 1953 in Iran to topple the government of Mohammad Mossadegh because he had had the temerity to say that the oil resources of Iran should be put towards social development and should be controlled by the people of Iran, not by an American oil multinationals. That couldn't be allowed to happen. And the reason is that the Middle East is the region that has two-thirds of the world's crude and oil reserves, and that the United States has understood is absolutely central to its projection of power globally. And that's for a couple of reasons. The first is that control of Middle Eastern oil, which is a central theme to what's now happening in Iraq, and I want to come back to it, is essential for the U.S.'s positioning itself against economic competitors on the global than the United States is. Japan and Germany at the end of World War II were very crucially dependent on those energy resources, and the United States didn't want them to have an independent course of development. So it was initially targeted at those two countries, but it's now extended to the other centers of power in Asia and in Europe, and increasingly the United States understands that India, China, Germany, other France, other European and other Asian powers cannot be allowed to have independent access to Middle Eastern energy resources. The other thing that the United States has understood for decades is that by being a hegemonic power in the Middle East, by being able to intervene, to topple governments, to back dictatorships, to control those resources, they also extend their ability to intervene elsewhere, in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, just as we've seen recently with the ability of the United States to engineer regime change in Haiti, following very quickly on their regime change operation in Iraq. If they want to assert their ability to intervene at will around the world to impose the conditions that are favorable for their economic, political, and military domination. And I think it's only in this framework that we can understand why it is that the United States for so many years backed Saddam Hussein, supported the rise of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq against the Communist Party there, and supporting the crushing of independent trade unions and democratic forces in Iraq to allow the Ba'ath Party to come to power. Then backing Saddam Hussein during the years of his worst abuses, which were then later trotted out to explain why we had to go to war in March of last year against Saddam Hussein. He only became a threat when he acted independently of the overall design and framework of U.S. control in the region by going into Kuwait, threatening to destabilize access to those energy resources. The goal of going into Iraq was to reestablish unchallenged U.S. hegemony in the Middle East and then beyond. David Frum is a speechwriter for the Bush administration who has a new book out right now with Richard Perle, that great thinker and intellect, called An End to Evil. This is a profoundly sophisticated analysis of world affairs. He put it this way. He said, an American-led overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the replacement of the radical Ba'athist dictatorship with a new government more closely aligned with the United States, note that part, would put America more wholly in charge of the region than any power since the Ottomans. So it's very clear that there's nothing about democracy here. It's about hegemony. None of the other explanations that we've been given for this war in Iraq have any credibility. Weapons of mass destruction, which of course we were told over and over again about, we know absolutely that they're not there. And keep in mind that Iraq was systematically surveyed with the most sophisticated technology for years before this invasion. Human rights abuses, you know, set aside the fact that the worst human rights abuses, you know, the example that they brought up over and over again was the gassing of the Kurds in Halabja. That took place in March 1988. And the U.S. escalated aid to Iraq after that massacre took place. And high-level meetings with Bush administration officials took place after that gassing. Set that aside, are we really supposed to believe that people in the Bush administration can't sleep at night thinking that there might be some person somewhere who's being denied their human rights and democracy, and that they're going to intervene in any country where that might be the case? Defiance of U.N. resolutions? You know, if it were defiance of UN resolutions was the criteria for U.S. intervention, then the Pentagon has got to start planning its operations for moving into Jerusalem and moving into Washington, D.C. to topple the regimes that are defying the United Nations. Al-Qaeda, again, there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and what connection does now exist was created by the invasion of Iraq. The war wasn't about any of these reasons. It was about oil, it was about empire, and it was about the American desire to impose a neoliberal agenda, not just on Iraq, but around the world. So look at the situation in Iraq. What does it look like today? It's absolutely right to point to the obscene behavior of Halliburton, Bechtel, Brown & Root, and these other corporations which are close to the Bush administration, which are profiting handsomely for this, from this occupation. But I think it would be a mistake to understand the occupation only as something about those the short-term benefits to those specific corporations. This is about a much longer-term benefit to a much wider group of American corporations and more American corporate interests and the state interests behind them. So, you know, in Iraq right now, people joke openly about AB and BB. After Bechtel and before Bechtel. After Bechtel, Iraqis have less electricity generation than they did before Bechtel. As corrupt, as horrible as their life was under Saddam Hussein, they had more regular supply of electricity, they had more jobs, and they had a more stable life than they now find themselves having under occupation. Iraqis are now also facing a situation where they're being overcharged for oil, which is being imported into their country by the occupying power. This is a country which has the world's second largest proven oil reserves, and it is importing at exorbitant prices oil from neighboring countries, and people in Iraq are having to stand in line for days, in some cases, to get basic cooking oil, heating oil, and gasoline for their cars. Meanwhile, the oil that is in Iraq is being used to fund the military apparatus that's imposing the occupation regime. But it's not just about that immediate short-term question of the control of oil. It's about using Iraq as a demonstration effect to threaten other regimes in the region, to try to force them to engage in economic agreements that will be favorable to U.S. interests, and also to try to leverage their power in Iraq to expand into greater change in the Middle East. So the United States is now talking about three initiatives after the intervention in Iraq. One is a Middle East free trade zone, which is designed to be like the free trade area of the Americas, CAFTA, NAFTA, and to knock down any barriers to corporate domination of the Middle East by U.S. multinationals. Then there's something called the Greater Middle East Initiative that the Bush administration is pushing, which is basically regime change in Iran, regime change in Syria, an attempt to topple other governments that aren't sufficiently friendly to the United States. This has also been called the Forward Strategy for Democracy in the Middle East. This insane idea that the Bush administration at gunpoint is going to bring democracy to the people of the region. And we can see what they mean by democracy if we look at the current occupation. The U.S. government talks about handing power over on June 30th. They want, in an election year, to convince us that they've handed over power to Iraqi authorities. Iraqis have now taken to calling the Iraqi Governing Council, the Iraqi Governed Council, which gives a sense of their understanding of who's actually calling the shots. But what's clear is that the U.S. has set in place a series of decisions that are meant to have binding effect on whatever government comes to power down the line in Iraq. So the investment laws are being rewritten, the trade laws are being rewritten, the constitution is being written, all of the basic framework of Iraqi society is being changed in ways that are meant to be beyond the control of future Iraqi governments to change. That is built into the Iraqi constitution. It's built into the decisions and the decrees of the proconsul, Paul Bremer, who's operating exactly like the British colonialists operated in Africa and in Asia a century ago. Within weeks of coming into Iraq, the United States had arranged long-term basing rights for U.S. military bases, and they had rewritten entirely Iraq's economic laws to allow 100% foreign ownership of any aspect of the Iraqi economy except for the oil industries, which will be, in which case they're trying to, in the case of oil, they understood that it would be too obvious and too offensive to say that the oil would be entirely privatized. Instead, they will put it into a nominally Iraqi institution, which is completely in bed with multinationals, not just U.S. multinationals, but multinationals from countries that supposedly opposed this war, France and Russia and a number of other powers. So the idea is to give a fig leaf of some kind of multinational intervention, multinational involvement with Iraqi control. And the same thing is the design behind this idea of bringing the United Nations in to give a fig leaf to U.S. occupation. Because even though the U.S. is saying we'll leave on June 30th, they're not talking about pulling the troops out. They're talking about U.S. troops continuing, in some cases, for years beyond the supposed transition of power. There's an economist named Jeff Madrid who looked at the investment laws and the economic program for Iraq, and he put it this way in the New York Times recently. He said, the economic plan already approved by L. Paul Bremer III, the American in charge of the coalition's provisional authority, is extreme, in fact, stunning. It would immediately make Iraq's economy one of the most open to trade and capital flows in the world, and put it among the lowest taxed in the world, rich or poor. These radical laws, he writes, have been adopted without a democratic Iraqi government to discuss or approve them. One would have thought failures of swift and sudden free market changes in Russia in the 1990s would have made even extremist economists cautious, but never mind such historical lessons. Iraqi planners, currently including the Bush administration, seem to assume they can simply wipe the slate clean. The new plan includes the top personal income and corporate tax rate to only 15%. That's the top corporate rate in Iraq. It reduces tariffs on imports to 5%, and it abolishes almost all restrictions on foreign investment. It would allow a handful of foreign banks to take over the domestic banking system. And then he notes, an even bigger worry for regional economists like Fadil Mahdi is the low tariff on imports. Mr. Mahdi is the regional program manager for the United Nations Development Program in Beirut. In an email discussion, he said this. He said, after long years of war since 1980 and the sanctions in the 1990s, Iraq's technical prowess in the civilian sector is worse than Russia's in the 1990s. Opening up to imports at mere 5% tariff will most probably ruin many producers and exacerbate unemployment. Unemployment right now in Iraq is running at 60 to 70%. This is even before all of these plans have been put into effect. So the conclusion of Jeff Madrick is this. He says the current plan is supported neither by theory nor experience, only by the wishful ideological thinking of its advocates. Its consequences, as in Russia, could be widespread cruelty. And I think that's an accurate description of the occupation of Iraq, widespread cruelty, and it's an accurate description of the effects of neoliberalism around the world, widespread cruelty. It's about creating wealth and power and privilege for a handful of people who are making billions of dollars in profits, while around the world, literally tens and hundreds of millions of people are denied access to basic resources that they need to live. Safe drinking water, food, shelter, decent accommodations, decent lives. The program for Iraq, the program for beyond, is organized cruelty, and we have a job to organize against it. As Arundhati Roy pointed out in her World Social Forum address, the struggle against the occupation of Iraq and the struggle against neoliberalism are the same fight. We have to link it, we've got to connect it. And we have to also understand that these fights against this war abroad, this war on the world's poor, the war in Iraq, is linked to a fight here at home. Because the war abroad goes hand in hand with attack on workers, attack on social spending, attack on the poor, attack on women, attack on immigrants, which is taking place in this country and which we have every interest in organizing against. We need to mobilize for April 21st to 25th in D.C. We need to continue to build an anti-occupation movement against the war in Iraq, and as much as possible, build connections between these different movements. And I think we also need to understand that this has to be a part of a long-term project. 6 years is absolutely enough. We have to abolish and work towards the abolition of these institutions. And we also have to see it as part of a broader struggle, I think, for an alternative system, not based on profit, not based on conquest so we can control other people's resources, not based on economic competition that leads to these insane wars like we've just seen in Iraq, in which and these insane interventions like we've just seen in Haiti, but a truly cooperative system based on meeting human need and based on democratic control of the world's resources.